work.
Jocks. Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control. Right here.
From PTI Worldwide Headquarters in Chicago, it's time for Stocks and Jocks.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm talking about Jimmy on the board. SP Futures up 25. NASDAQ Futures up 214. Trying to bounce back from a couple of days on the downside. Do we have Professor Liu?
Good morning, sir.
How are you, bud?
Hey, just great. Recovering a little bit from cold, but hanging in there.
All you dudes that are world travelers that fly around, everybody know who's been on an airplane has had this cold or flu.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's a real. I don't know what it is. I hesitate to call it flu because I haven't had a fever, but it hits you pretty hard.
Some of the people here have had the fever. It's a relatively new strain, and it's not in any of the shots, allegedly. If anybody took the flu shot, it's not in there, evidently.
Yeah, well, it seems to be hitting people here in Denver, vaccinated, unvaccinated. It doesn't really matter. And I have kind of backed off from getting an annual flu shot since the COVID vaccine debacle. So it hasn't seemed to affect me that much, but you'll hear me coughing occasionally here.
Well, I remember the Jerry Ford swine flu shot. That was the last one I took for like three decades after that fiasco.
I was at the Academy when that rolled out, and it ended up knocking down about a quarter of the cadet wing with side effects and illness. So. That caused people to back off a little bit.
Well, plus it never jumped, thank God. But it never it was
it never jumped
from the swines
materialized. So playoff football for playoff football for both our cities this week.
Yeah, I think you guys got a good team. Well, all these teams left are pretty good. Even the Bears actually. Well, I don't know if they're that good, but the other people have managed to degrade injury wise, and the Bears sort of haven't. They still got their offensive line attack, except for the one guy.
So you guys are in L.A. right? Wait, is that game Sunday?
No, it's here.
Oh, it's here.
Yeah, Bears have a better record.
Oh, I thought you were playing in L.A. Okay,
well, LA's a wild card.
Yeah, no, we are the second seed.
Yeah.
Okay. Outstanding.
Matter of fact, if the Bears win and Seattle loses, they'd host the third one. Right.
Yeah, and Denver. Right, and Denver's the top seed. So. If we can win, and we've got Buffalo, and it's, I'm keeping my fingers crossed. It's an off year for Buffalo, so Denver can win. They can go some distance.
Well,
I'm not a believer. I'm sorry to say, I'm not really a believer in either one of our teams. They've looked so bad at times. You know, I just kind of throw my hands up.
I don't know when I've seen. So much of this is injury related, it seems. And I was listening to who's the team that lost the Chargers. Looked like absolute dog manure, right? And who was doing the game? Was it Romo or Aikman, I think? I'm not sure, but he was saying last year the quarterback was basically getting his ass kicked. So they went out and they got two tackles and propped that whole thing up like you should if you're the general manager. Now at the end of the year, both of those guys were hurt, and they're back right where they started from, and he was on his ass again. And you really can't. I mean, you look at when John, what's his name, Harbaugh got fired, and he. I mean, Lou, I'm no genius, know more about this than me, but seems to me that safety from Notre Dame, he's the best safety in baseball and football. First half, Rodgers couldn't get down the middle at all, and all of a sudden that guy gets a concussion, he's out. All of a sudden, Rodgers goes down the middle of the rest of the game. I mean, I don't know if the average fan picks up on that, but there's people that are key people. And if they're out, if you lose a tackle and all of a sudden, hey, you couldn't run the ball tonight, well, duh. Right? I mean, everybody's not. Was it San Francisco had an all-pro tackle? He's out. They put another guy in there. It's not bad. He's out. They put a guy in there. It was his first professional snap in a playoff game.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it makes a difference. I'm sorry. Who's playing, right?
I'll tell you that my father, again, the offensive line coach at Minnesota, said that he did his best coaching jobs on years when, I mean, they would lose. I remember one year they lost, I think they lost four starters. And he shuffled and moved guys around and, you know, finally got a working line about halfway through the season. You know, they'd lost three or four games at that point. And then they started to, you know, those guys gelled and they started to win again. And he said, yeah, we won't get credit for this, but this was one of, you know, this was a real success story that we were actually able to stay competitive after losing really the basis for the entire offense.
Well, the Bears beat the Packers twice in a row, and I'm going to say who's the guy the Packers got from Dallas? That tore his ACL. What's his name, Jimmy?
Micah Parsons.
Yeah, that guy plays these last two games. The Bears don't win.
It was close enough.
That guy makes that much of a difference.
Right. Yeah, well, and I always go back to, I think Nick Saban said it best, you know, when the chips are down and you're in a tight spot, you don't look to your plays, you look to your players.
Yeah.
And if you've got, you know, you call the number of the superstar and rely on them to deliver. And if they're not there, you got to rely on something else. Now guys step up, but you can't coach, you know, you can't coach talent. You can't coach inherent speed and size and strength and to some extent aggressiveness.
Well, they were all over the talking heads were all over Bill Cowher last week. I don't know if I had a chance to mention this when we were on last week, but he was amazingly adamant about the. They said, "Well, what do you think about resting your players, and you know, getting a lower seed or getting an away game or something?" And he just went off. He goes, "I need my people healthy." He basically goes, "I don't give a bleep where I play. I don't care who I play. I want my people healthy. And if they're not healthy, doesn't matter if it's at home, it's in my bedroom. It doesn't matter." And, you know, it was interesting. The other guys are looking at him like, "Are you serious about this?" "Yeah, I'm real serious about it." He goes, "I'd much rather have an away game than a home game if my people are healthy there or not here." He goes, what am I going to do without my players if my players are on the bench hurt?"
Yeah, and every coach that I knew, you know, all the guys that coached with my father and then people I've met since then have said that week of rest, if you can give your guys a week off, it makes a huge difference. And they are, especially at that time of the year, everybody, by the time the playoffs roll around, everybody on that team is playing hurt. Everybody's got something wrong, a muscle pull, a tear, some nagging injury that you know, is not, you know, not debilitating, but is there. And so to be able to give people a week off, that especially now with the intensity of the practices and the fact that, you know, football's a year-round game for these guys, you can giving them that rest is a huge advantage.
What do you think the story is?
The coaches all thought it was a huge advantage.
What do you think the story is of the Ram quarterback hand? They haven't mentioned it.
I'm sorry, Stafford?
Yeah.
The hand injury that he got when he hit that guy's helmet?
I mean, well, he completed like every pass before that happened. He completed like two after it happened.
I mean, you know, it's his throwing hand. I don't. If he's jammed a finger or something like that, I'm sorry. You know, there are no minor hand injuries for a quarterback or a baseball pitcher
or anybody.
You know, that's a huge deal. We'll have to see. I'm going to be really interested to see what San Francisco does. I mean, they kind of stunned everybody with that win last week, and if their defense is always suspect. But if they can get, you know, if they can get Purdy and McCaffrey, the guys I look at are Purdy and McCaffrey. I think those two in a combination can do some real damage. If Stafford can keep Nacua, you know, in the game, and get balls to him, I think that'll at least keep it competitive. But who knows?
Well, the San Francisco's offensive line's in bad shape. A lot of these guys are limping in. What? So you think the Who had the buys? It was Seattle and Denver, right?
Seattle and Denver.
So
yeah.
That's got to be a big advantage, like you're saying.
I think so. Although again, I'm not sold on Denver. I mean, I like what McVay's done. I love the changes that he's made in the locker room. I like the focus on defense, but I'm just their offense has been, you know, horrendously inconsistent. A little bit like you guys.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think the Bears are not that good, but they don't quit, and the other teams around them seem to be falling apart. What do you make of last weekend?
That's Denver. I mean, Denver looks awful for three quarters, then all of a sudden they turn it on.
What do you make of? I'm just an impartial observer, but I watched some of these games. I probably saw 7 to 10 lead with helmet hits that early in the season would have been cause for ejection. None of them even got called. I mean, that play in the Packer game, that guy should have been called on Rodgers.
Oh, when he almost took Rodgers' helmet off?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know, Tom. I saw the replay on that, and I said I assumed the official didn't see it, but I didn't track exactly where the official was. But holy cow! I mean, if you see it in slow motion, you see Rodgers' helmet just almost come off.
And then he fumbles it. They were in the game until that play.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It was a terrible football game.
Yeah. Until then, and then all of a sudden, I'm not so sure anybody wants to pay those guys, the Texans.
You know, good. I hearken back to the old line. You know, offense sells tickets, but defense wins ball games.
They've got some guys on defense that are really fast.
Yes, they do. And they reminded me, you know, one of the things I look at when I watch the games is on defense. I watch the tackling, and one of the things I noted when the Ravens had that unbelievable defense with Ray Lewis, when a Baltimore defensive player made a tackle, the ball carrier stopped. You know, there was none of this dragging people down. When they hit people, they dropped them, and over and over again, and that's what I saw with the Texans. Their tackles were solid. They were knocking people down. They weren't just dragging people down. They were knocking them down, and I was going, oh, okay, shades of, what was it, 2002 Baltimore, 2001
yeah.
Baltimore.
Well, now, if all of a sudden the calls change, is it? These guys hold their finger to the, like the guy in Casablanca, he holds his finger to the wind, and the winds were coming from how do the refs all of a sudden decide that we're not calling that, like, during the playoffs? But it sure looked to me like, even on some ball carriers, a couple guys were being stood up, and then some other guy flies in, it looked like Doug Plank, for God's sake, and nothing was called.
Yeah, there's that playoff game, I'm trying to remember who it was with. It may have been with the Colts, where the Patriots, Belichick told his players, I want you, we're going to go out and we're going to rough up their receivers, and you're going to commit pass interference calls. Not blatant, but you're going to interfere with their receivers from the start of the game going forward, because we think it'll take the officials about a half to figure out what's going on and to start making those calls. Because we know the officials are told, do not take control of the game unless absolutely necessary. And so for the first half of that game, none of Manning's receivers could get anything because the Patriots were basically committing pass interference on every time a ball went out, that they were committing pass interference. And then the refs at halftime sat down and said, we can't let this go on. And they came back out and said, okay, now we're going to enforce it. I suspect that that's a real thing, that the officials are told, this is playoffs. Unless you see something really blatant, be careful. You don't want to make a call that's going to change it, going to change the game. And I think that's the way it works.
Would you, Kevin?
I think they do sit down at some point. If they see something really bizarre going on early on, they sit down and say, "Wait a minute, we can't tolerate this." But if the game's been relatively clean for most of it, something like that hit on Rodgers goes unremarked.
Well, Kevin was talking yesterday, and we were opining that where was Lou when we need him. He thinks that there's a good chance that the game would be better, especially now that people are constantly hand fighting everything all the way down the field on these receivers, that He thinks a 40 or 50 yard penalty is way too much, especially when these calls are both touching each other.
Yep.
He thinks to go to the college game where it's 15 yards might make more sense.
Oh, I absolutely think that's the way to do it. Or even 5 yards, like a hold, a defensive holding call, 5 yards and a first down. Okay. You know, you're not, that way you're not changing the game. And I understand that the thought process is, well, he would have caught the ball if you hadn't.
Well, some are so blatant that the guy would have caught the ball.
Yeah. I mean, oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. But the assumption has always been he would have caught the ball if you hadn't messed with him. And I think in the majority of these kinds of plays, that's not the case. You know, it's because you're not getting the kind of drag somebody down with the ball almost there kind of defensive ball play. And you know, the short answer is that the receivers and the DBs are so much better in terms of judging, you know, judging flight and stuff like that, that the really flagrant pass interference plays are really not that frequent.
Well, they are when the ball's short and the guy stops and the defender runs into him.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
I'll give you that. So maybe you have a flagrant pass interference where they advance the ball but the vast majority of them are only 5 yards and a
Well, I also haven't seen
10 yards and a first down.
They say there was interference, but the ball was uncatchable. I haven't seen. It doesn't seem to matter if the ball's uncatchable now if the guy hits the guy.
Well, that gets added in with the flagrant call.
Well, the other question was
something else.
The referees groups work as a team during the season, and then they pick what they think they are the best ones and put them together for a team the first time during the playoffs. And I wonder if that's a good idea.
I don't think so. Because again, the coverage, the viewing angles, you get practiced with people who know, okay, this Michaels guy is going to wander, you know, 5 yards, 15 yards off the ball for this kind of a player in this kind of a situation. So I need to move, you know, I need to move my or adjust my position slightly. It takes a little while to establish that kind of pattern recognition with your people. I would prefer to have a team that had worked together, but you know, at the same time, the team's only as strong as its weakest link. And if you got a guy who misses a major call, the league doesn't want to put those guys in there.
Well, wanted to ask you, the one guy I mentioned to Kevin yesterday, he couldn't.
By the way, have you seen? I have not seen this, but I don't watch a lot of live games anymore. Are you seeing any analytics applied to the officiating crews?
Not really. What do you think, Jimmy? No, I have not.
I'm waiting for some sportscaster or some, and maybe the league's told them not to do this, but I'm waiting for some sports broadcast team to come up and say, okay, this officiating crew has called X number of holding penalties in you know the last 15 games, and they call them more on this side or that side.
Well, they sure do that with umpires in baseball.
Of course they do.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering why we haven't seen that in football.
Well, I don't know. That's a good question. Maybe they don't want them to do that. Hey, we have to talk a little bit on. You ever seen so many balls in the air in foreign policy in your life? Boy, it's pretty hard to trade this stuff.
I was debating about whether to raise foreign policy this morning. No, I think I made a mention a few weeks back about, I think we may be seeing something that we haven't seen, at least as well defined in probably two decades. And that is the sort of the outlines of a kind of a grand strategy starting to take shape with respect to the United States and how we approach our
allies
and enemies.
I've talked to not that you haven't, but the people who, and I don't want to get too political here, but the people who somehow still feel, and again, could very well be right, hope they are, that somehow deep in Trump's brain is this moral and very, planning person that has this grand strategy, kind of think one way, and people who think he's a raving maniac think it's all chaos. And I don't know. I hope the Trump people are right, but I don't. I wonder. I think whatever the next day is a cover up for the day before. Looks to me. And I don't think it's
chaotic.
I think it's all wrapped up with Epstein and all kinds of other stuff. Whatever is the bad news from the day before, we lob one out the next day, and people can't track it. And
so here's my take. I don't think it's chaotic. I do think we are looking at a coherent grand strategy that looks at the world from the perspective of the United States interests and says we are going to unabashedly promote U.S. interests, and U.S. interests are we're going to be able to draw straighter lines from our policy positions and our defense positions, straighter lines from those positions to our national interest than the kind of circuitous routes those lines have gone through before. So that says certain things, like we're not going to tolerate a significant Chinese or Russian or Islamic fundamentalist presence in the Western Hemisphere. We're going to work to thwart that. We're going to say that we're not going to shoulder and support economies that don't match up with our cultural ideals. We're going, especially if there are ostensible allies. We're going to deal with war and instability as directly as possible. The problem that I see with that is that the guy who's effectuating this, or the guy at the head of the foreign policy program who's effectuating this, has just an irrepressible urge to shoot his mouth off and say stuff that I think he thinks he's helping, but I don't see it. And I'm not a New York real estate magnate, and I haven't negotiated, billion-dollar contracts, and maybe I don't get the subtleties and the nuance, but I think that's what's happening. I think we are shaping. You're seeing a U.S. foreign policy being shaped that is not based on taking the rest of the world's interests into consideration.
Well, I think you need to.
Well, and that's so that's where you see a lot of the collisions in terms of how people view, how people view the United States, and I think his position and the position of a lot of the people around him is, look, we haven't been throwing our weight around. And we thought that was in our best interest, but it hasn't worked out that way.
Some people you don't want to put in charge of the arsenal. The man is deranged, Lou.
Yeah, I agree with you. I understand that, and when he first took office in 2016, I don't know if you remember the conversations we had, but I said at that point, from a foreign policy perspective and the perspective of our enemies, and at that point China had not rearmed to the extent that it has now, I said there's a certain advantage in having a mercurial, unpredictable chief executive in place, because nobody knows what this guy's going to do. Nobody knows what his actions are. Nobody knows where the thresholds are that would cause him to react with something that would be, hugely problematic for whoever we've targeted. And there's an advantage to that, because it causes people to be extra careful.
The inconsistency, Lou, I mean, I look at the thing in Venezuela, and we have people on the show, and I have a lot of friends that are backers of this, but I try to stay. Actually, I have to stay somewhat neutral, not in the thoughts about individual people, but in what's going on, because that's what I'm doing for people. I mean, I have to make sure that I don't let this kind of stuff affect my trading for people. But I look at what's happened in Venezuela now. Do I want massive amounts of Chinese influence in this hemisphere? Well, we had a hell of a lot of Chinese influence here. We got $700 billion we borrowed from the guys. And it looked to me like in the Venezuela situation, they essentially got their ass handed to them. They gave this guy $60 billion for oil, and guess what? They weren't getting half the oil they were supposed to be getting. It looked to me like they stuck their finger in a place and they got it burned. I don't know if it was that major of a deal for me. I'm not a fan of Maduro, and I was not a fan of Chavez or anything like that. At the same time,
that's a limited way of looking at it.
Okay, but okay, let me finish.
From a Chinese perspective.
The last week, he decided we're going to ship the best chips that we make over there, as long as he gets a cut. As long as he says the federal government, I don't know where that check's going. As long as we get 25% of the gross of the stuff that NVIDIA's sending over there, that's much more valuable to the Chinese than getting in a bad deal in Venezuela. I mean, the inconsistency here is mind-boggling to me.
Well, and again, I'm I don't know. I'm kind of guessing here. I don't know the value of a certain amount of inconsistency in terms of how we're dealing with this stuff. I think our foreign policy people look at this from minute to minute to minute.
Well, who's our foreign policy people? Steve Miller?
No, it's Rubio. Well, Miller's probably in there, but it's Rubio and Vance and Trump. And,
oh boy, that's a name somebody good, will you?
Well, I mean, you don't like any of those guys. I get it.
No, I actually really like Rubio, but I think he has to. He wonders what room he's in, actually.
I'm getting the impression that this is in their minds, and again, looking at this from a perspective of we have to maintain or we need to maintain some kind of deterrent posture with China. We don't want China backed into a corner where it feels it has no alternative but to strike. At Taiwan and at our interests in the Far East. We don't want to we want to cut off the drain in military equipment and just the people that are being killed in Ukraine. We want to stabilize the Middle East and try to eliminate the malign influence of Iran, but without causing more chaos like we did with Iraq. So, I mean, you're right. There are a lot of balls in the air.
It all seems to come back to him getting something, him or his family getting something. I mean, who's getting the 50% cut of NVIDIA stuff? This deal stuff. This is weird.
I can't draw lines from these deals to or these foreign policy positions to his family business. And again, I've already said I don't like the fact that his kid and who is it, Bessette's kid are out, you know, campaigning on you know, making deals and selling Bitcoin. I'm not a fan of that. But I haven't seen the kind of quid pro quo. I certainly haven't seen the quid pro quo that we saw with the previous administration.
Oh, this is way beyond that. Way beyond that.
What foreign policy?
Of the betting deal with Venezuela? Did you see that? I've never seen anything that crooked.
I'm sorry, the what?
The people that made the bets on whether we were going to take Maduro out, this betting service.
I'm sorry. That's not. I have not seen Donald Trump.
Donald Trump's kid is on the board.
Government. To benefit one of his kid's companies.
Okay, the kid is on the board. The bets for Maduro, to take Maduro out, somebody bet. Now, this exchange, you don't make, in fact, if you make a thing on FanDuel, you're making the bet with FanDuel, okay? This one is almost like a stock exchange where they match people up on both sides. So on one side, a group bet, allegedly, this money that Maduro would be taken out by the end of January. And somebody bet like 30 grand or something, and it would paid off 400 grand. Yet there's $10 million bet that the U.S. is going to invade Venezuela. And on the one they paid off on, the other they didn't. And what 60 Minutes missed is somebody is on the other side because they decided that it was not an invasion per se. So they didn't pay off on the invasion side. So if somebody knew what was going to happen, they would actually bet on to take Maduro outside, win that side, and fade the other side, because it was not considered an invasion, and win on both sides. And every time I see something,
do we know that happened?
Yeah, yeah.
Do we know that his kids were involved in
it? No. I know his kids on the board.
Well, okay, but that's.
But they're there. They're always there. They're always omnipresent in these things.
Presumably, as a member of the board, he's not doing much betting.
Why do you say that?
Because that would be a conflict of interest.
On what? Some foreign company that nobody's anything about?
I mean, that would be a massive conflict of interest problem for anybody. But unless you've got some indication that actually happened. I mean, it's intriguing.
This has been written up everywhere because the amount of complaining on the side of the people who aren't getting paid on the invasion piece, that's all over the place. They're pissed off.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
That's why I brought it up. From a perspective of, well, we didn't technically invade. We went in and we got out. But they
had just gotten their license to do business in the U.S. just when Trump's kid came to the place. So they weren't allowed to do business here until somehow they found Trump's kid and he gets them out a month later. This happens. I'm not accusing him of taking the other side of these things, but these people are everywhere, Lou. They're everywhere.
I'm going to try to avoid the conspiracy thought.
Me too. I'm sitting there going, well, hey, this I guess could happen. And all of a sudden I go, wait a minute, what's this kid doing? How did his kid get there?
I can see. Just thinking about it, the last thing I would do, if I was his kid and I was actually gaming this, is bring some. Why not just bet on foreign markets? Why not just have the thing bet outside the U.S.? Why would you bring it into the U.S. and expose it to U.S. federal scrutiny?
What's the federal scrutiny on one of these things? None.
Oh, I think there could be plenty. Well, 60 Minutes is in on it. Okay, you don't think there's New York Times reporters just chomping at the bit to try to find something?
You think
on
Pam Bondi's going to demand who's on both sides of
these
trades?
It doesn't matter what Pam Bondi's going to do. There are 10 million investigative journalists who would love to get into that. I can't imagine that they would do that. They would bring it into the U.S. to be subject to scrutiny in U.S. law.
I am not so sure that getting one of these. What do they call them? Betting on whether the Pope is going to heart attack next month. I don't know what kind of scrutiny does that thing get.
I don't know, but if it involves the Trump kid, or any of the administration kids, you know that there's 10 million investigative journalists at the New York Times teething up on this.
I'm going to say the New York Times calls these guys up and say, I want to know who's on both sides of these transactions. The guy hangs up the phone. They have no reason to give it to him. I bet they won't even give it to the IRS.
But that doesn't matter. You've got people inside the organization. I think that's a terribly risky thing for them to do, and I think it would be a stupid thing for them to do. And I haven't seen much of an indication that the people that are involved in these kinds of things are that stupid. You never know. They could be.
I think you can get yourself so involved where you think you're bulletproof.
I agree with that, but not on something like influence peddling, like this direct influence peddling, well, especially after what happened with the Bidens.
I'll tell you what, if I was a guy who just said, boy, I'm going to bet on the Maduro coming out by the end of the month, like this is the middle of January, but I'm going to fade the invasion piece. I think I probably have a pretty good idea what exactly is going to happen. Just saying.
Well, I mean, Tom, I don't know when the bets were made.
They started being made early, and with increasing regularity. Evidently, the one on the Maduro being taken out was a new client, and it was all in the last week.
Well, that makes sense because the New York Times and Washington Post both had leaks from somebody who was not a pro-Trump person, who was trying to thwart the invasion, had leaks that the invasion was coming in advance of it and held the stories to their everlasting credit. So I'm pretty sure it wasn't Donald Trump or somebody in his family that leaked that information.
I have an amazing view of this, Lou. And I don't know what it is. I mean, I hope somehow or another, I really hope I'm wrong and all this stuff straightens out. But I look at this and I go, I can't imagine even how the place is structured. I mean, if you and I, and we'll bring Kevin with and Hal, if we were, you know, quad presidents, I have a feeling that the four of us would really be busy. Four of us, let alone one guy being president, would really be busy like all day long, because there's an awful lot of stuff. Who the hell has the time to worry about busting up the East Wing? Who has the time to decide to take a public golf course in New York and steal it for Trump? I'm not New York, I'm in Washington. Who's doing all this stuff? It seems like it. I can't imagine
he
you.
He didn't steal that golf course.
Does he
own it now?
They're on their way.
Does he own it?
Not yet, but all the dirt from the East Wing excavation has been deposited on the golf course because they want to make it hillier.
Okay.
But who has the time for this stuff? I mean, I can't imagine, you know, if you and I are in the Oval Office, all of a sudden the next week, Lou's going to be seen out like trying to scalp used cars or something. Well, wait a minute. This is a full-time job, isn't it? I mean,
this is every president has some personal idiosyncratic interest. Gerald Ford, you know, got the swimming pool redone in the White House. Why? Because he liked to swim laps.
Yeah, well, but there had been one there. It was taken out. There had been one there that was taken out.
Yeah, but it wasn't used.
Oh, Roosevelt used it all the time.
Yeah, but I mean not when he was there. So he had him redo and rejigger the swimming pool. And so I mean it's the same thing. Trump is a builder and a golfer. So he looks at this and says, okay, I want to fix this, and I can.
I'm just saying I know you've read who I'm talking about, Bill Stevenson. He ran the MI6 during the war for a man called Intrepid. That was his call sign.
Yes.
They said the dude, on any given day, you couldn't like even get, because he was buried in reports. He read the equivalent of a Victorian novel every day, in addition to having planning meetings with people. I don't think you would see a guy like that out worrying about taking over somebody's golf course in the middle of the day.
But now
we have the people we have, and this is just not Trump. The people we have in office now, what is their skill set exactly? I don't know what it is.
Skill set? Well,
it's to get in office. That's a skill set, obviously.
It depends. It depends. You know, I mean, they're politicians. At the top, it depends what they were hired for. I mean, the Hexeth skill set
is was. I'm waiting to hear that one.
Well, Hexeth skill set. Listen, Hexeth skill set is to basically break crockery in the Department of Defense, shake up the management system, and to basically reinvigorate our recruiting and military status. And that's what he's done. He was not brought in because he knew how to manage a multi-billion-dollar weapons program. That's going to somebody else. He's an inspiring Secretary of Defense. And if you don't understand that, I suggest you look at some of the videos of him out doing calisthenics with the troops and look at the morale boost and look at our recruiting numbers.
Well, I mean,
he was brought in to shake that whole system. That's what he's doing.
Depending on what you look at. And if I don't know how far some people that just hate the Democrats are willing to go here, but I was reading this thing yesterday from a French general. Oh, God, the French. We hate the French. Screw the French. Okay, I'll do that for everybody before they have to do it themselves. He goes, a week from now, if you read the news, we could be fighting the U.S. He goes, the thought of anybody invading another NATO country from NATO, he goes, nobody's thought of that for 80 years. What's this guy doing? If you look
he's negotiating.
Okay, now,
Do you think we're going to invade Greenland?
Two people.
Tom, do you think we're going to invade Greenland?
Well, let me tell a little story here. Two people.
Do you think? Just answer my question. Do you think we're going to invade Greenland?
I don't know.
Okay. You think it's a possibility?
I think somebody shouldn't say it if it isn't a possibility.
Okay. And Trump says things that are inflammatory. I have not heard Trump say we're going to invade Greenland.
He said everything's on the table.
So?
And the people around him have said a military operation is absolutely possible.
Of course it's possible.
Okay.
Nobody's there, you know, somebody asked that question. Right, somebody idiot asked that question. Well, is it possible? Yes.
I've known you a long time, and I absolutely respect you. And I think, by the way, you're not a guy somebody would mess with. If I was the sheriff in your town, and I showed up with 15 squad cars along, next to the house in Colorado, who you love up in the mountains, and I take my gun out and I point it at your dog and mess the hell up with your wife and scare the shit out of her, and I say, I really want this house. I think it's mine. We need it for the county and whatever. And all of a sudden I leave and the guy behind me trundles up. Ah, that's just the way he is. Where he really says he'll give you $250,000.
If we had done that in Greenland, I would be singing a different tune. You know where we've done that? We did that in Venezuela, and we're getting ready to do it in Iran.
I would reread the last 2 weeks and how many times Trump has said if it takes military action, that's what we'll do.
We have not taken any steps like you just described. And I have not seen. I mean, he said, you know, all options are on the table. Well, that's what you say in negotiations, but you know, you don't know what his options are.
But when somebody says, "Mr. President, does that mean military?" and the answer is yes, it's not. Here's the thing that's infuriating the hell out of me, Lou. And I could be totally wrong. I don't.
Short answer. I don't think we're going to invade.
I don't either. But what the thing of it is, I don't. Here's what I kind of don't understand why, because these are my favorite people, people I respect. I don't think it's your job to say that's not what he really means. I mean, why can't the guy stand for himself? I mean, he just said it. The French heard it. It's not your job to tell the French general, ah, come on, it's not what he really means. The French general might say, Mr. Michaels, why did he just say it if he doesn't mean it?
I think you could buy the president a T-shirt that says, as one of my favorite T-shirts, that says, I prefer to maintain a certain moral ambiguity. And I think that's his negotiating style. I negotiate like that? No. But I don't think we're going to invade Greenland.
I do think we
are posturing in a way that basically says to, and again, you're seeing a much different kind of U.S. in terms of foreign policy than has been out there before, where we're taking the consideration of our NATO allies into account. I don't think he's doing that anymore. I think his position is, these guys are freeloaders, and now I'm going to demonstrate to them the effect of their freeloading, which is...
They are freeloaders, and I think there's a lot of it. I guess here's...
Tom, do you know that the Canadian Army... Canadian Armed Forces, they don't have an army. They just have an armed forces. The Canadian Armed Forces have more generals than they have tanks.
We're probably close to that, aren't we?
No.
We got an awful lot of people up top. How many generals we got per grunt?
No. Well, I think we have less than 1,000 generals. And we have a lot of tanks. The idea that would be their defense posture is pretty telling. Do you remember my telling you 4 or 5 years ago that the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, which, you know, pretty important, the Luftwaffe had fewer than 75 workable fighters?
I think you're right. I'm not going to debate you on that.
So. Why do they do with Russia right on the doorstep? Why do they do that? Because they know we're gonna save them.
I think that there's there's a huge difference in what the people on your side are saying here are forgetting one big thing. We wanted to be in control.
I'm just saying
we didn't want in 1955 Germany to have some big army with the idea
we're not in 1955.
I understand it. And all of a sudden, after
that war ended in 1991. So
my point is, we wanted to control the world.
Yes, we wanted.
And all of a sudden, somebody comes in and says, "You guys aren't holding up your end of it." Okay,
all of a sudden, this has been going on for 30 years now.
Okay.
For a generation, we have been telling the Europeans, we really need you to bump up your defense expenditures. And they've said, yeah, well, we'll get to it when we get to it. But in the meantime, we've got all your airplanes, tanks, bombers, all that stuff. And Trump, you know, in 2016, Trump said, I've had enough. They didn't get the message then. So now
I'm just saying the message was very muted before, because we wanted our people in Germany. We didn't want that base to be...
Not starting in 2016.
Okay.
And he's been giving a very clear message, and now he's giving them a very clear message of, listen, you're not going to play ball with me. Okay. Here's what that means.
Well, we're going to invade you.
No, just, all options are on the table.
Okay, so
and they look around and go, what are we going to do?
The idea that a U.S. president threatens another NATO country that's never done anything bad to us, Denmark, that I can understand, we're going to invade you. Now, you may say he doesn't mean it. He just said it.
It's not my style. He is not threatened to put troops in Greenland. He said, he said, all options are on the table. You know, we need this. We want this. We've got to have control of it because of what's happening in the Arctic right now. I promise you, this is a breath of fresh air in terms of our foreign policy focus.
I think what's been happening
in the Arctic is really problematic for us.
In terms of what he wants to accomplish in the Arctic. By the way, if we really cared about the Chinese, we wouldn't take money from them. We wouldn't have their students here. We wouldn't be selling them war crap.
Well, at the same time, we're doing that. We have to recognize that they are a global competitor that are seeking to undermine
us. We're going to take out our weaknesses here on Denmark.
Well, I mean, this is not, again, I see a coherent strategy there. It's iterative, it's gradual, it's not all at once, but I see a direction. So
and,
I hope well, I'm right.
I hope you're right.
I hope we're both right. I hope we're both hoping that's what's going on.
I would say that if NATO feels that, which we are a part of, feels that the big threat really is China, which is hard to say when Russia's the one invading.
Well, NATO doesn't feel it's China because China's trade surplus is now with Europe.
Okay.
Our trade surplus with China has gone to one of its lowest numbers in years.
The trade
surplus with Europe is over $1 trillion.
We still have how many thousand Chinese students here paying an arm and a leg to go to our schools? And by the way, we do,
and that'll be the next step.
And we owe him $700 billion. Are we going to pay him back?
But he's doing carrot. I mean, we're doing carrot and stick, Tom. It's not all in one direction. It won't be, but the weapon systems we're developing, the weapons we're forward deploying into the Far East, that is a signal to them. The airfield that they just built on Yap, that is what 100-200 miles from Guam. I mean, that's a signal to us.
Yeah, I think the Chinese are a real problem. What I'm saying is I'm seeing very massive inconsistencies in how we're dealing with it. Their crummy deal with Venezuela was not the tip of this iceberg.
Well, that. They were getting a lot more than just money out of that deal.
How do you know they were getting anything out of there? They looked to me like they did a deal for oil, and they weren't getting the oil.
Well, that's because you look at, again, you have a very mercantile kind of outlook, and that's great. And I think you're right probably 95% of the time. But that's not what they were.
I don't have anywhere near the mercantile outlook that Trump has. His is everything's mine.
That's not what they were there for. So.
Okay. I mean, I'd almost let them sink with Maduro and Chavez rather than us.
Well, but they're not going to sink, you know. And we see the same pattern in Africa. They come in, you know. Now they have Chinese. Venezuela's got I think it's China's telephone system now that's in place in Venezuela. So they've now got complete control of the communication system. They've got complete control of their IT systems in a number of African countries. They've got complete control of their airfields and their ports.
I don't understand.
And there is no such thing as a non-governmental Chinese company, especially in international work.
Okay, what I'm missing here, and I know maybe Carl's done this to me. I look at this stuff and I go beyond different presidents being in office, and I look. We have been on a deal for a long time, and I know we did this because we were doing it when I was at Pullman, for God's sake. If somebody wanted to build a refinery in Africa or a water treatment plant, or maybe not so much that because there's no revenue in that, refinery or something, something, somebody here, or maybe in Britain or someplace, was more than willing to use the Export-Import Bank to put this refinery up. And the idea was not only were, this is Pullman Kellogg, not only, and my friend Robin used to do the Export-Import Bank stuff. You'd put the thing together, the Export-Import Bank pretty much always got paid back because the refinery is, you know, makes money. And they would all, we put up a bunch of them in Saudi Arabia and all kinds of places that maybe we weren't even the best friends with these guys. We did that. Not only was it to put the place up, but it was to put the Americans' good name in there and all the other kind of crap that goes with it. And all of a sudden, for a few decades, we stopped doing that. And I mean, I'm not saying we should or shouldn't have, but so there's a vacuum there. So the Chinese go, well, if you're not doing it, we'll do it. But it's what it's the same thing we used to do.
We don't want them to.
Well, I know, but we don't want to do it either. But somebody needs to put the damn thing up. I mean, I'm saying what we got out of the business and we're
it shouldn't be the Chinese.
Okay, but what I'm saying is we were that person for decades. All of a sudden we're like, we don't want to do this anymore. Okay, the Export Import Bank became all. What has it been lately? It pretty much is. It's to lend money to Boeing for people to buy Boeing jets they can't pay for. It became a very Defense Department-oriented thing where people were buying fighter jets and not paying them back from some of these countries, and we ended up bailing out Boeing. Okay, that's not the way it was. It was people here putting up water treatment plants, putting up refineries, putting up roads, the same thing the Chinese are trying to do. So if you know, some place in Africa comes to us or Brits or somebody and they go, we need a road, and we say, we're not doing it, we're not lending you the money, and the Chinese say, we'll do it. What do you expect them to say?
Well, I mean, I don't care what I expect them to say. I don't want that to happen.
Oh, okay, but I mean,
that's where I'm taking. You understand? I'm taking a kind of silly position here, but that's our foreign policy is now being driven by that kind of an outlook, which is we're not going to do it, but we're not going to we don't want our enemy to do it.
That
doesn't mean we have to go in there. It does mean we may have tried to frustrate that.
I'm not making it sound. I hope the listeners don't think that I am pro-China in this. I'm not. I'm just saying. At any time, you see an economic vacuum, somebody fills it.
And we apparently are in the business now of saying we're not going to allow that to be filled by certain people, or we don't want it filled by certain people.
We let the Japanese take over how many buildings and golf courses and everything 30 years ago in this city.
Sure.
And they got their ass kicked at every one of them.
But you're asking for consistency on foreign policy. And there is a consistency there, but not in the way you are looking at it.
I'm going to say right now, if the Chinese, we have a policy now that if Chinese people want to come over here with a lot of money, we give them citizenships.
Well, we give them a green card. Yeah.
No, we give, if you, what is it? If you make an investment to where there's 10 employees, you get 3 citizens or something.
You're talking. I mean, I have some familiarity with the EB-5 program. My understanding is that you get a green card, I believe.
I think you get family and everything else.
I don't think you get voting rights.
Oh, okay. I think you get some. I think if you spend enough money, the Canadians used to do.
No, that's the truth. I mean what did the president call it? His golden.
No. This was before Obama.
Okay. So yeah. We're talking about the EB-5 program. So that I do know something about. That was not full citizenship. You got a residency status and some other stuff, and that was the result of a certain amount of investment into designated areas, and it was as you might guess, it became rife with corruption.
The one I remember reading was if somebody made an investment enough to where like 100 people got employed.
Yeah,
here you got like 7 citizenships.
It wasn't citizenship. It wasn't full citizenship. Okay. It was residency status, green card. It was that's true.
Well, didn't
that was a it's called the EB-5 program.
Well, I just hope that all this stuff. That there is some, we get some kind of an idea in where we're going here, Lou. And And I think the economy is falling apart because none of the promises are ringing through down the system yet. Now maybe they will, maybe they won't.
But I thought our economic numbers looked not too bad.
Oh, don't
I mean, inflation
it.
Inflation's down.
Don't why do you say that?
Well, because the price indexes that I'm seeing, and frankly, the drop in gas prices, which I know affects almost everything, is significant.
Okay. The inflation rate when the man took office was 3, and it's still 3. By the way, he's reviewing the numbers now before they even put them out. So
okay, so what I'm seeing when I go shopping is a much slower rate of increase on prices on the stuff that I buy, and you know I assume that's the result of inflation slowing or the price increases slowing. I attribute part of it to the drop in oil prices and the associated effects. I see certain items going way up that are affected by the policy, you know, that are still being affected by the policies of 2 or 3 years ago. I get that.
Wait a minute. You didn't just say that the price is going up are Biden's fault and the price is going down are Trump's fault.
I'm just noting, for example, beef is the one I'm thinking about, where we had a shortfall in cattle that occurred 2 or 3 years or a year and a half ago, and now we're seeing the impact, and it'll be a while before that gets back up. The oil prices have come down. Excuse me. Now I'm fighting what you're fighting.
Yeah.
The oil prices have come down, and I'm going to credit putting an administration in that said its goal was not to shut down fossil fuels. So, in any event,
the amount of oil is almost the same. It went up the entire time of Biden's administration. The amount of oil drilled.
I'm just saying the prices didn't, and the refineries were not operating at capacity. But anyway, my impression is that unfortunately a lot of the good economic news is not really percolating down to the people that voted for Trump right now.
The economic news is tepid at best, and it's been that way for 3 years. Coming out of COVID, you can't trust any of the numbers, Lou.
Okay, well, and that's where I was ultimately going to end up was, based on our conversations and the positions you and I have talked about, I can't really trust anything coming out of the Department of Labor or the Bureau of Labor Statistics anyway.
Well,
you
can, Lou. I think. I spend way too much time on this. What ends up happening is there's two pieces of the CPI, and you're right about the gas prices. Okay, but anything else to do with an automobile is to the moon. I mean, the last month had the price of service, mechanics, and so forth down. Give me a break. It's down like 1%. Nobody gets their car fixed now because not enough people are buying new ones, trying to get into a mechanic. But what has happened is the two glaring errors in the CPI that they refuse to fix, I'm going back 5 administrations, are the hospital side and the owner's equivalent rent side. Both of those are amazingly undercounted. And that's what's killing people. There was a nationwide service.
The health that you and I have talked.
Yeah, but there was a nationwide whoever does these surveys. I don't know who the hell does it, but there was a nationwide survey about what inflation was hurting people, and the two things that came flying right out on the survey were medical expenses and houses. So as long as you lie to people, and I'm not saying Trump's the first on this, he's not, but he's sure not changing it. Are those two things? If you were to take the and I've said this 100 times, if you were to take the medical piece, which they have as 6% of your basket, and raise it to 21, which is what it is of the economy, and go back 25 years, I'm going to say we probably were in a recession for 25 years. It's that bad.
Yeah.
And if you look at the owner's equivalent rent piece going back 25 years, they have it up probably double. And I'm going to say it's at least triple the cost of home ownership. So those are the two big fat lies in the CPI. Now, the price of rice, the price of gas, the price of chicken, yeah, it goes up and down all over the place. I'll roll with that. But we still have that 35 or 40% bulge that came out of COVID that's never been in the numbers. And that's what's hurting people. It really, it almost doesn't matter, Lou, whether we're 2% or 3% or 2.5% going forward. It's the 35 or 40 that people are still getting stuck where the sun don't shine. And there's no attempt to redress that. I mean, the fact that...
Tom, I'm getting some other audio track on my feed here.
Really? Jimmy, what are you doing over there?
I'm not hearing anything.
Oh. Maybe some right winger. What do you think of Bill Ackman giving this guy who shot the lady $10,000, Lou?
I honestly cannot hear you with the audio track that I just had.
You sure you're not? Are we being intercepted by the government?
No, sorry. Hold on. It may be on my end. Hold on. There we go. I just killed it.
Okay.
He's using the computer.
We listen to some good music or something.
Some autoplay thing jumped up on my feed. Anyway,
I wouldn't be a bit surprised if you don't have somebody in your computer from the government.
Given some of the things I've said, I wouldn't be surprised either.
The fact that you're on with us. Hey, so what's good with you out there? Are you skiing? What's going on? What's the economy like out there?
The skiers are in real trouble. There's snow, but not enough of it.
Really? I thought you started out...
And it's warm. I mean, this is going to be... We're going to have a kickoff for that Bronco football game this weekend. It's going to be the first kickoff we've had under 60 degrees.
Wow. Well, it's going to be 8 here. Do you want to come out here and watch the Bears?
Yeah, right. I don't think I'd like to sit in Soldier Field with the wind coming off Lake Michigan in 8 degrees.
And who do you like? Who do you like in the two games?
I like Denver against the Bills because Buffalo's been so inconsistent. But I mean, with Stafford hurt, I got to go with the Bears.
Yeah, I almost do. What about?
Yeah, I would. Let me put it this way: I would love, as much as we've criticized the Bears, I would love to see that football franchise go deep into the playoffs this year. I would love to see that. I'm a Central Division guy. I love to see Central Division teams do.
Yeah, I kind of do too. But the idea that they're running around with their hand out everywhere, and that part, the last thing we have is $5 billion for these guys, but. I don't see where Indiana.
We're doing the same thing here. They want to put a new stadium up.
I thought you just had a new stadium
in downtown Denver.
I thought you just got a new stadium.
No. Mile High got renovated, but they didn't build a new one.
Oh, baseball got the new stadium, right?
Baseball got the new stadium. Okay. But that was in the mid-90s.
Do you believe how much money that the dude in? I'm getting my states. The guy where's the Kansas City stadium now? Is it Kansas or Missouri?
It's in Kansas. It's in the Missouri.
All right, so the Kansas guy, the governor, is willing to give him like everything to bring it across the border. Is the guy an idiot? What does that do for him?
I don't know. I mean, I Arrowhead is a barn. I was there last summer. It's a barn. But yeah, I hear you. Hey, listen, I'm going to drop
right,
off
buddy.
So that Wayne and Andrew can talk, and I wish you guys a great week and a good weekend. Stay warm.
Get some snow, will you? We need it. Lake Mead needs it. Everybody needs it.
Yeah, we do. We need it here desperately.
All right, buddy, take care. Jimmy, we got our guys?
Yes, we do.
Guys.
You got me.
How are you? our guys.
Yeah, I'm fine. Well, hey, thanks for sending this cold weather down here to Florida. It's going to go down to 30 degrees tonight.
Now, do you even have a furnace?
Yeah. Well, most people down here have these heat pumps for electric heat, but they're very rarely used, of course. But I think mine will be in use tonight. And the only reason people don't use them is it drives up already very high electricity rates down here.
What
We need Andrew to unmute.
I should know this, but what a heat pump can only get you what 30 degrees or 40 degrees or something change?
Yeah. A lot of people, you know, a lot of old people live down here, and they also rely on space heaters. But you know, they can be pretty dangerous, especially with people, you know, knocking them over, and maybe causing fires. So,
God, I remember the ones where you had the little stove in the room.
Oh, yeah.
A kerosene stove.
Oh, yeah. You know, I remember being in Europe in these very old houses where everybody gathered in the kitchen, and they still had those old potbelly iron stoves. And of course, when people retired for the evening, they'd go to the bedroom and get under a bunch of covers. So, you know, that's how they dealt with the cold over there. And that I guess the last time I saw a place like that was back in the 80s.
Well, you can still see in actually my building has them. If you go into a building in Chicago or yeah. Philadelphia or some of the older cities, and you see like a brick wall that looks like it might have been a fireplace, but there's no fireplace. Look up on the side of it, and you'll see this round thing. It looks like a plate, like yeah. a dinner plate. Well, that was the opening for the kerosene stove to go in there and go up and out, and it just was covered up. I mean, I knew several of my relatives. You had the kerosene stove in the kitchen or the dining room, and that kind of heated the place. And the colder it got, the closer you stayed to the stove, basically. Yeah. But the problem was.
As long as the tap rooms stay warm.
Oh, yeah.
There,
well, you got to make sure that your water didn't, you know, your pipes didn't freeze and keep them moving. I mean, it was, you know, 20 below zero, it's a problem now. It really was a problem back then, for God's sake. Your car didn't run, nothing ran. I mean, it was.
Oh, yeah.
Do we have Andrew?
Yeah, good morning.
How are you?
Good. I'm listening to the conversation with interest, and I'll contribute that. I was recently, something came up on YouTube about how people kept warm in the Middle Ages. And the bottom line is, even in a castle, unlimited money, it was cold. And they had some of the innovations that you're talking about, but also at times, they didn't really know much about what they were doing, but apparently they had beds that were like 12 or 15 feet square, and as Wayne was saying, sometimes just everybody would pile in under the blankets, because otherwise they'd freeze.
Dogs and cats, and I haven't read this in a long time, but somewhere there was a... It's got to be a long... You guys remember this, but some people were remodeling castles over in Europe, and it was a big shtick where people were investing in these things.
Yeah.
And a lot of research was done, and evidently they were amazingly unhealthy places to live, because somehow or another the limestone or whatever they used would like sweat or something, and the humidity was, they were always really damp, and people who lived in castles didn't live very long because of the, somehow or another it was leaching off something bad, and it was always damp, and even if you had a fire in there, you never could get enough fire to get the dampness out of it. It was something really bad about living in castles. It was, well, you're better off in like the side hut.
Well, if we ever get depressed about something currently, just I try to remind myself we're living far better than anybody, just about, than a king or a queen back in the day. And it's also relevant that they had no concept of germs and so forth until, even in the U.S., until, let's say, the late 1800s. And so people didn't wash their hands. People got all kinds of diseases.
RFK Jr. has changed all that. He doesn't believe in germs either.
The good old days coming back.
Well, it's you read these histories of these families, you know, the Roosevelts, and even the real rich families. Every one of them had a couple of kids that died along the way from stuff that you wouldn't die from now. Nobody had any teeth. I mean, if you were 35 and had your teeth, you were rare.
I think in Mount Vernon. On display, I think George Washington's wooden dentures are on display there.
Plus, they would pull them before they had Novocaine. That had to be a trip.
Yeah, but they had whiskey.
Yeah. They just...
Well, in my encyclopedia of useless knowledge, I wanted to look up the origin of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Do you guys know what that comes from?
Yeah. The entire family would take a bath on Saturday night, and the water got so dirty if the baby was in there, you couldn't even see him. And you could literally...
They went in strict progression, apparently.
Yeah.
The man first, then the wife, and then by age. And so the baby got the last bath, and they didn't change it because they didn't have much water. And I don't think it was every Saturday night. It might have been once a month.
Well, it might have been, yeah.
The water was so dirty that there was a danger of throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
You can't imagine if people didn't take a bath, let's say even for a week, and you're the fourth guy in the same water. I think you're better off standing with a sponge, to be honest with you, but that would just be me.
Well, I think the concept was the baby didn't know how to complain very well.
I'm not so sure you didn't put germs on the kid rather than take them off at that point. Of course, they use that lye soap that probably ate through everything. Guys, how could we, you know, I mean, we had talks with Kevin and Lou and other guys, and I certainly appreciate, you know, where they think a lot of this stuff is going, and a lot of what we're seeing is kind of style points. But I think sometimes, you know, if you have a really bad sense of humor and you lob it on a few women and they take it the wrong way, it's not a style point, it's an insult. You have to understand the person receiving your largesse, and I always try and put my, you know, turn it around. If I was on the other side, how would that sound? And we have somebody that, you know, I don't think he plans on invading Greenland. I sure as hell hope not. But the French general says, in a week we could be fighting America. He goes, how could that even happen? That somebody would even think of invading another NATO country.
That's right, and I guess there's a huge European force now being sent to Greenland. The meeting yesterday between the Danish and Greenland foreign ministers in the White House, I'm a pretty good observer of diplomatic language and also just facial expressions. And they came out of that White House yesterday, and then they gave a news conference up at the Danish embassy. And the look on their face, it kind of looked like Zelensky after he left that combative Oval Office meeting. That did not go well. And then the Danish foreign minister said, we had a frank discussion. Well, frank discussion and diplomatic code is they were arguing. And there must have been an instant readout over in Europe, because right after that meeting, the Swedish said, we're sending troops to Greenland. They were followed by the Germans and the French and the Norwegians. And I guess this morning, a few hours ago, the UK said it's sending forces there. So the idea of a U.S. Oh, and Canada, too. The idea of the U.S. fighting our former, because I think they are former allies, is a real possibility at this stage.
How did 99.9% of the people in this country not look at that and go, what are we doing?
I mean, I don't want to think it's happening, because there's an investment in, we want life to be normal. We want, and for those who voted for the president, we want to think he's got a good plan. But sometimes, as Wayne was saying, I concur with Wayne, they're playing, the Europeans and Canadians are playing for time. And in fact, the New York Times, I think yesterday, published a story. They went up there and they said, you know, reported, well, what do people in Greenland think? And the gist of the article was, we've got a good healthcare system up here, and we need it. It's on the, you know, kind of Northern European social welfare state, and we don't want to be on our own under a U.S. type of healthcare system.
Well, Andrew, what do we have there now? We have a base, right? We've been there forever, correct?
Well, it's the old Thule Air Force Base. They've changed the name. I think it's, you got to be careful saying this stuff in the Inuit language, but it's Petufik or something like that. Yeah, we've been there since the early Cold War. It was remember the old dew line, just an early warning?
Yeah,
they had these big, like, they look like big old white golf balls. Well, that was one of the bases there. I was actually stationed in Iceland, which was on that same net. We had what they call tropospheric data relay sites that bounced off of the ionosphere or troposphere, I should say. And then Thule, Greenland was one, and there was one in Canada, one up in northern Scotland. And we've been there forever. And during World War II, apparently there were several American bases there to basically keep Greenland from falling in the hands of the Germans.
Well, it also was the weather station. That's where the weather came from.
Oh yeah. And right now the EU is building a ground station for laser satellite communications. Reason they picked Greenland is there's apparently this part of Greenland they picked has very little cloud cover, which makes it ideal for laser communications. They have one up in the Norwegian Arctic islands, Svalbard, but they've had a lot of Russian activity there. And I'm beginning to think that when Trump says, oh, there's Russians everywhere in Greenland, that he's mixing it up with Svalbard, also called Spitsbergen, where the Russians actually have rights there, old mining rights, going back to the Soviet days. And I think he's confusing the two. If he just sees Greenland on a Mercator map projection, looks like it's bigger than the United States, and he's so dumb he doesn't realize it's not really that big. But I would also point out that recently his new ambassador to Iceland, this guy named Billy Long, who was in Congress and is a auctioneer, that was his job in Missouri, he arrived in Iceland and said, oh, we're going to make Iceland a 52nd state, and I'm going to be the governor. So it's no longer Greenland; it's now Iceland, apparently.
I don't understand why the people who are Trump followers, and, you know. By the way, if you were to, I don't know where I get myself locked into this, you know, if you were to put up all the 10 things that Democrats and Republicans are their alleged staples. I'm going to say I'm on the Republican side and probably seven of them. In terms of any kind of fiscal type of stuff, I'm to the right of Attila the Hun. You know, because I think the numbers add up no matter what side you're on. And this idea that somehow you have to, because you elected somebody, and the guy acts like an absolute buffoon on the world stage, you know, saying we're going to take this over and that over, and by the way, you don't get to do this. By the way, my name's going to go on the place. I mean, I don't see how why even if I'm a very conservative guy, why should I need to like that? I guess I don't get it. It seems to me that if all of a sudden this Arctic is in play with the Russian and the Chinese, which it could very well be, isn't that exactly what NATO's for? To get together and say, okay, guys, we got to beef it up in the Arctic stuff because these guys are heading in here. Isn't that we're supposed to do this together? Isn't that the idea here? I mean, what am I missing?
That's absolutely why NATO was formed. And remember, under Joe Biden, NATO expanded to 32 countries, including historically neutral countries like Sweden and Finland. And there's other countries still waiting to get in. It looks to me like Trump is out to destroy NATO, which only serves the interests of one Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, you know, that's. I was thinking about that this morning as I was pumping gas, driving in. That horrifies me. I'm thinking, why would anybody want to wreck NATO except for that?
Exactly. So, you know, do we have a Manchurian candidate type person in the White House? So I think a lot of people in Europe, Greenland, and Australia, Japan, everywhere are asking that question right now.
How does somebody, I was mentioned with Lou, and you know, Lou's wobbling in some of the stuff. He doesn't like the idea that they're involved in all this business stuff and everything. But he thinks there is some logic to to the New World Order, that NATO was slacking and other stuff. And it, you know, and he's not wrong with that. But I'm stunned on just on a daily basis. Who's thinking up all this crap? I mean, who has the time to worry about bets on some off exchange? And who has the time to go try and steal a golf course? I mean, how do you? The idea of me managing money for people all day—that's a full time job. The idea of me running off to try and make money scalping a used car in the afternoon—I mean, I would never even think of something like that. Yet these guys, they think of everything. Part of me is jealous, I guess. I don't know, but how does that even happen?
Well, Andy, you're closer to you're the Trump whisperer up there in D.C. So,
well, I was going to say, you know, a certain division of labor. So there might be, you know, one part of a team keep the decision making the way we, you know, some insiders wanted, and others are how do we make money out of this? And when there's enough money to be made, there's plenty of room to hire people who are experts at whatever's needed. And so it's very interesting story again in the New York Times yesterday, I think today's print edition, about apparently we, the United States, or the Trump administration, reportedly, according to this long story, are already selling lots of Venezuelan oil through brokers. And I'm thinking, boy, that's quick.
Oh, I think that these guys are pretty quick on this stuff.
So that's what I mean. That wasn't decided in the last week. To put that into place, but if it also helps explain, if you have the Nobel Peace Prize winner Machado coming to Washington today, I think, to try to sweet talk people and say, hey, I'm the real opposition leader, I should be president, but you know, and she'll be heard, and but the preliminary indications over the last week are people say, well, we don't really want her.
Well, that's what Trump said that himself. Trump said that himself. She's a nice lady, but she's not what we want.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Is if she has some thoughts that she's the Democratic, you know, popular, rightful leader, is she going to go along with a plan to have these brokers come in and already selling tens of millions of dollars of oil on the international market? And maybe you need a tried and proven dictator regime in place to do that.
But he'd be our dictator.
Yeah, so I think there's a logic. It's just a logic that is not that appetizing to a lot of people. The ordinary person, or even the extraordinary person like you, who's trying to read the charts to help your clients make money.
Well, I mean, the thought would cross most people's minds that if you're ragging on a place because there was an election and the guy didn't leave, of course we have the wrong guy to be ragging about that. But if you actually were concerned about that, one might think the first thing you do if you knock the guy out is put the person who actually won in the job. But that thought isn't crossing anybody's mind, is it?
No, where's the money in that to be made?
Yeah.
Yeah, and we also had Trump egg on these Iranian protesters. And I thought this past week, I've been in Iran. I was there in 2014. And, you know, I thought this protest may be gaining some steam where the government may fall over there. So you had Trump egging them on, saying, oh yeah, well, I might militarily hit Iran to help the protesters. He says they shouldn't kill any protesters. I guess that doesn't apply to this country.
No.
Only to Iran. And then all of a sudden he says, oh, I've been talking to the Iranian government, and they promised me they wouldn't kill any more protesters, which means that he totally undercut this opposition in Iran, and now the news out of there, the military is taking over, and the rebellion looks like it's over with because Trump pulled the rug from underneath them. It's you just got to wonder. I think he likes authoritarians. It's just that he wants to be issuing them orders. So whether it's the Ayatollah or the guy, the woman who's the vice president for Maduro, he wants to deal with people like that. He doesn't want to deal with people who favor human rights or were even democratically elected to their office.
What was the James Bond movie, World Domination?
Yeah.
How does this all? What do people here do? I mean, in terms of the people that have wealth, I think he's smart enough to realize that somehow the market can't go down. They'll do whatever they can do. I mean, if the market drops 40%, I mean, he's going to impeach by his own party if that happens. I mean, but right now it's not. I mean, you can't wait to get the Fed guy out of there. What if Powell doesn't resign?
If I were him, I wouldn't. And now we're seeing who in the Republicans in Congress are behind this effort of Trump. They're saying, well, you know, if he just cops a plea with the U.S. attorney for D.C. that's a woman, Jeanine Pirro. She'll just drop the charges if he agrees to resign. Well, what kind of deal is that? But we're now seeing those who are advocating that, like this Senator Kramer from North Dakota, at least we're seeing who the real Trump loyalists are. And those who are backing Powell, they may be the people, when we're hearing more and more about there's a group of Republicans who are quietly talking to Democrats about impeaching and removing Trump. Maybe it's this group, because we're talking the Fed, and that means that's a lot of people's savings and bottom lines and what have you.
Well, but it's stunning to me how, and we have, you know, like I said, people near and dear to me that are convinced that he lied before Congress. And I talked to a few attorneys the other night. I wanted to ask you this, Andrew. I don't think, you know, when you watch NCIS, all the big naval ships have a NCIS officer on the ship, right? I don't think that the Justice Department, on a daily basis, listens to everybody in front of Congress and scribbles down what they think is a lie and checks it out and goes after them. Isn't that Congress's job?
Well, of course. It's becoming increasingly political, so it depends who complains and what kind of clout and relationship they have. And it's never been non-political. There's always been this element, and in fact, when I co-founded the Justice Integrity Project in 2010, it was to look at very serious problems that existed then and previously. But I can say that following this now very closely, it's vastly worse. And so while it used to be isolated situations with some systemic problems, such as, you know, people who could afford a great defense attorney were likely to get a better treatment. But now it's extremely arbitrary, and you have huge numbers of resignations, both out of principled concern by career attorneys, but also self-preservation. And the self-preservation part is they realize that maybe they put 10 or 15 years into a legal career, that their bar licenses will be jeopardized if they're asked to do things that state bar associations ultimately will say, no, you can't lie to the court. You're losing your bar license for what you did in 2025 or 2026.
Andrew, what is the alleged lie that this guy said to Congress? I mean, whenever Trump accuses somebody else of lying, you know, I almost have to burst out laughing. But what exactly did he tell these people that's allegedly the lie?
Well, just to be clear to the listeners, I was talking about lawyers in the Justice Department, and you're talking about witnesses to Congress.
No, I'm saying, but in general, the Department of Justice doesn't listen to every congressional testimony.
No, of course not. Yeah. So what they would do, and we're seeing this again happen yesterday, Hillary Clinton, who spent 13 hours testifying about Benghazi about 7 or 8 years ago, and handled it very impressively, I think. She refused to testify to Congress because, and I've read the protests by her and Bill Clinton, they gave a sworn statement, quite extensive, on the Epstein case, but they look on testimony as a perjury trap. And a perjury trap is kind of what happened to Bill Clinton and the Ken Starr, Monica Lewinsky investigation, where you box people in and take some statement and turn it into a perjury charge when ordinarily there'd be a statute of limitations problem on the conduct, but you get fresh clock set off by the testimony to Congress.
To be clear, if I gave testimony on something 10 years ago, whatever the issue was, all of a sudden Congress decides to drag it up again and bring me in front of Congress, if I contradict anything I said 10 years ago, I don't remember exactly what I said, or was not sitting in front of me, then one of the two of them is going to get me for perjury.
Exactly. And by the way, that's exactly what happened to 1985 University of Chicago Law School graduate James Comey, the former FBI director, and he was indicted last year, and I'm covering his case in Virginia, in the courthouse right across the river from here, and he was in a complicated indictment. He's accused of misleading investigators, and it's trying to put new life into his actual actions, which are long expired under the statute of limitations. And that prosecution is so flimsy, it's going very badly for the government, but that's an example of how perjury traps, more or less.
Why don't we head off to break and let's kind of stay on this when we get back. SP Futures up 30, as if you're up 238, trying to bounce back from the last couple days. We'll see if it does. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks. Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients, and you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
What are you going to do with your old car? You can try selling it. You could junk it. Or you can donate it to Heritage for the Blind. Your car will be towed away for free, and your donation is tax deductible. Just call 1-800-639-8620. Heritage for the Blind accepts cars, vans, trucks, and boats. It doesn't matter if your vehicle runs or not. It'll be towed away for free, and you'll be supporting those that need help. Heritage for the Blind is a nonprofit organization that helps the visually impaired live fuller lives. Call right now to donate your car. And as a special thank you for calling, you'll receive a free 3-day vacation voucher to many exciting locations. Call Heritage for the Blind right now. Call 1-800-639-8620. Donating is easy, and your vehicle is towed away for free. Plus, you'll get a free vacation voucher. Call now, 1-800-639-8620. That's 1-800-639-8620.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right now.
We're back.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell, Jimmy on the board. SP Futures up 32. NASDAQ Futures up 249. Let's do a real quick trip around the world here, but not. DAX up 11, so nothing going on there. FTSE up 44.4%. CAC around down 16.2, so Europe kind of a dud this morning. Asia, Nikkei down 230.4%, Hang Seng down 76.3, Shanghai down 13.3, so they said hardly anything doing there. Bonds up 2 base points, 4.16, so we've seen a little bit of creep up in the 10 and 30-year. Matter of fact, the 30-year is quite a bit higher than the 10-year now. The 30-year is 4.8, and the 10-year is 4.2. We haven't seen that kind of spread in a while. Oil, it's down 279, back under 60. It was under up over 60 for like one day, 59.23. So it's still hanging around as 57 to 61 level, and it's been stuck there for a real long time. Gold is actually down a little today, $23, but 46.12. Silver down $2. That's 2.5%, $89. It was over $90, which is really something in silver. Foreign exchange, everything. Dollar is a little stronger again today. The euro is 116.0, was over 117. And the British pound is 133.7, was over 135. Crypto, which was strong yesterday, is down 869 today, 96,680, still way up from the 82,000 a couple of weeks ago. Jimmy, how about a quick traffic weather sports? Not much sports. Bulls actually eked one out, but other than that.
Yeah, yes, they did. But quickly on the traffic side, inbound Kennedy from Montrose is at 28 minutes. The inbound Edens from Lake Cook is at 42 minutes. The inbound on the Eisenhower from Wolf is 42 minutes. And the inbound from the Jane Byrne Interchange, it looks like we have an accident because it is up to 39. Quickly in weather, the weather in Phoenix is going to be 54 degrees with a high of 78 and plenty of sunshine. Here in Chicago, it is the exact opposite. We are, we are currently at 17 degrees with a high of 26 and possibly light snow this evening. In sports, yes, we, let's go to the Bulls. The Bulls did win last night, surprisingly enough. They must have put up enough three-point shots. But they did eke it out over the Jazz, 128-126. Back to you.
The we had a little bit of a lake effect shot here in Chicago, guys, for about 2 hours yesterday. All it did was put ice on everybody's car, everybody's sidewalk, everybody's alley. It was the most disgusting little storm. Then you can watch the Bulls if you want to see. Andrew, I think you played some ball. We have this new style of defense called the Ole defense.
Well, it's been around.
Yeah, it's been around.
You see it in the All-Star games where sometimes the score might be, you know, 160 to 145 because nobody wants to get hurt.
No, it's just
like the Matador, let him go through.
Ole. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of how I don't know on what level we want to tackle what's going on, because like I say, there used to be a lot of variables when you manage money for people when you trade, and now the variables are kind of, there's so many of them. But I kind of noticed that there's, and I don't know enough about all these companies, but you see companies that kind of move together, that depending on where this AI is going, and you'll see like Micron way up one day and maybe Microsoft will be down. And there's a lot of intricacies here that I don't know if anybody even really knows, or even if there are any, it's just different people buying one place and everybody, momentum trading jumps in, and just because something goes up, people jump on it, and there's a lot of that still. And it's hard to figure out what is going on in the world. You have somebody who says, we're going to invade a NATO country, maybe, it's on the table. Other people say, it's just his style, don't worry about it. Other people take it seriously. Now we're talking about 10% interest rates on banks, and that had wouldn't you love to have been on that phone call between Trump and Elizabeth Warren?
Well, to go back to what you just said, you may be looking at the herd mentality, and if people are in a position and like well paid and so forth, if you do what other people are doing up to a point, that's buying time and safety, as opposed to, the ideal is the brilliant, independent-minded person who does things on their own, but that's easy to be vulnerable.
When I was younger, I used to go to downtown Philly, and I'd be walking down Market Street or Broad Street, and then I'd stop in the middle of the sidewalk and just look up at one of the buildings. Soon there'd be like 15, 20 people stop looking up, and I'd walk away, and then you'd see a cop come up to see what the problem was.
So you had time for your humor back in those days, Wayne.
Well, I mean, that's the herd mentality, I mean, you see somebody do something, you gotta copy them.
Well, I want to just get a sense of history here, and I know you guys touch on the economics, and you touch on antitrust and lack thereof, and you touch on how many banks, the big banks that are all, well, a couple of them are probably over the size they're supposed to be, and nobody will tell them to get smaller. I did maybe 3, 4, 5 years ago, it was before COVID. I did a study, again, I don't have all the information in the world, but I did a study on the interest rates had gone from whatever, back in 20 years ago, from like 6% down to zero, or where were we? We were like a half of 1% for a while. And I did a study on credit card rates, and there's a site you can go to. I probably have it here buried somewhere. And they talk about credit card rates, and they also are nice enough to you to give you the spread between prime rate and credit card rate. And over a period of however many years I did, when the regular rate went from like 5 to 0, credit card rates actually went up. And the spread between like the prime rate and the credit card rate is now like massive. So when you look at, it's one thing to say your credit card rates are 25% or 18 or whatever they average. It's quite another to say that your Fed funds rate has gone from 5 to 0, and oh, by the way, the credit card rates have gone the other way. And yet, the minute you turn on your radio or your TV, you're going to get some blithering idiot who's reading a script saying, Fed lowered rates today, you should see this in your credit card rates like next month. Nobody ever, how is it, what combination of lack of antitrust, lack of competition, something, how could those rates for regular people shoot up at the same time every other interest rate in the world is going down? I mean, I don't know the answer. I'm asking.
It takes political will from knowledgeable people to enforce what are basically pretty vague antitrust laws that were created over a century ago. And to read the precedents in a certain kind of way. When I was at the University of Chicago Law School, Frank Easterbrook was a professor in our antitrust class, and he was also a judge on the Seventh Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals, and he'd also written a textbook on antitrust, and he was so eager to dispute the precedents that he was almost pacing like a lion before the class would started, as he'd rip into what he considered bad previous court decisions that he thought were overly restrictive. So there's room for even very educated, very intelligent, knowledgeable people to dispute what the law should be in practice. And so that, I think, helps explain what you're talking about. Who's enforcing things under what theory? And if you, there's no total consensus on that.
You know, how much, Irwin, you guys, you know, you're banging around with people all day. How much of it is just, I'll use myself as an example, how much of it is just abject stupidity on the part of consumers, meaning me? And I will say this, that I have a, I think I've never used a damn thing, but I think I have a credit card from Credit Union One. I think I'm like 8% or 9% or something if I ever used it. Yet, I also have two or three others, I don't know how I ended up with them, that are these, you know, 2% back, 1.5% back, that I'm guessing the rate's 22. I use those all the time. Is it, have we been gimmicked away from the actual use of a credit card into other stuff? In other words, I think most people, and I know, I mean, Larissa was on yesterday, and she teaches a lot of, you know, more college. I don't teach college, and she does a lot of family work and everything. And she says people just, they spend too much. And I was under the impression that a lot of people on credit cards just never see themselves. I've paid off, God, it's been, I can't remember the last time I had a balance. So I look at the rate, I'm almost dumb enough to say, I don't care if it's 50%. I'm never going to be there. Yet, guess what? You know, if all of a sudden I get an emergency room visit in a place where I'm not covered or something, or, you know, I get a transmission out of the truck, I might be there, right? I mean, nobody anticipates that they're actually going to have this balance, and then you do. And if you'd have thought about it and said, well, if it ever happens, I'm going to scour the earth for a place that actually has a 10% credit card, and I'm going to apply there, nobody cares as long as they're getting their 1%. I mean, I guess my question is, how much of it is great marketing on a part of these people and consumer stupidity?
I think it's more the latter, because I know people who just, they're in constant debt, and it's debt on debt and interest rate on interest rate, and they don't seem to care. They run up, you got these tremendous balances, yet they're going out to eat almost every night. You know, they just, for some reason, they were never taught, or they were taught and forgot about it, how things like savings and finances, personal finances work. I remember when I was in college at Ole Miss, I hate to bring that up, but I had to get some credit hours so I could graduate a half a semester early so I could get out of Mississippi. And I took this, believe it or not, a home economics class. It was an easy A. And actually, they were teaching college people. And I got to say, I learned a few things, but it was basically about, you know, home finance, you know, all, you know, figuring all these students were going to soon get married and have families, and how you had to, you know, balance things out and pay for that kind of lifestyle.
Well, the Trump's threatening the Insurrection Act in Minnesota now. Martial law. Hey, so Andrew, let's ask Wayne a very personal question. Was he happy or sad that his team lost? Would he wanted the coach to get paid the bonus, so he was willing to have the team lose so the coach didn't get the bonus, or did he want him to win?
Wayne is an expert on many topics, but the Ole Miss football coach contract is not one of them.
Well, the deal was, if even though he had quit, if they won, he was going to get a big bonus.
Look, I remember when I was a student there, they built a $1 million dorm for the Jocks, and mostly for the football team, and we were living in dormitories that were actually built by the WPA during the Depression, and I mean they were nice, sturdy buildings, especially when there were tornado warnings in the area. You didn't worry too much, but they were old and pretty decrepit overall. And I remember they put that $1 million out, yet our library was about ready to lose its accreditation as a university level library because they didn't have enough books in the stacks. And I just said, wait a minute, $1 million for this dorm, and they're going to take the accreditation away from our library. That was my experience.
There might not have been a lot of demand from you students to read these books.
Well, that's another issue. I remember talking to some of my professors. I realized one way to get a good grade from professors was you go out drinking with them. And they told me stories that the dean came to me to say this football guy I had in class, he's hardly ever in class, but you got to give him a C. You got to give him a passing grade. I got a lot of stories like that. So right from the faculty themselves.
Well, when I graduated, I think I was graduated high school. My brother did grammar school, and my stepfather was in one of the first. Remember it was revolutionary at the time, University of Chicago, the executive programs. Remember those things?
Yeah.
Where he went and got his MBA, and in 1 week he went on Friday, and the next week he went on Saturday, and the Friday day, the teachers and the students immediately piled in the cabs and went to this bar called Martini's, and it had martinis. I'll clean this up, but so they're in this cab with Walter Fackler, who's the head of the business school. He wrote a bunch of books. He's a famous guy, and he's sucking on this big stogie in the front seat, right? So the guy in the back row goes, "Dean Fackler, what do you think of Nixon's wage and price controls?" And it's funny how the Democrats always blame the inflation on Jimmy Carter when the wage and price controls were like two guys before Carter. You can revise history. So they said the dean takes a big drag on his stogie and goes, "Well, boys, let me tell you, wage and price controls did for the economy what pantyhose did for whatever." And the guys in the back seat are going, "He didn't just say that." Anyway, he was a character. But you remember those, the wage and price controls? What a ridiculous... I actually had to go through that stuff when in college. It was so damn complicated. It got to the point where some people had wage and price controls. It got down to where everybody had wage controls, but very few people had price controls. Remember that?
Yeah. Do you still have your Jerry Ford win button?
Whip inflation now.
we had those on the trading floor. Everybody's wearing them on the trading floor. I mean, it was so. What if this was gonna? Let's out of all the stuff that just came out, we've done another thing. Now we're damn near martial law in Minnesota. What could anybody do to lower these rates? Anything? I mean, you're not. I don't see how if you don't figure out a way to have more people competing in here or doing some stuff. That's a massive undertaking to take a look at that whole industry and see where all the rates things come from and all that stuff. It's not something you do tomorrow with an executive order, is it?
Well, I don't think so, but I'm worried that we know he just bailed out this guy in Argentina, his buddy, with billions of dollars of U.S. taxpayers' money, but I'm just worried that talking martial law, that we start to have the kind of economy you have in authoritarian states, and they're never good economies. They're based on the whim of the leader, whoever the leader is.
Well, we'll have Andrew opine on this, but it seems like whatever side of this starting you're on, if you're on the side of, no, you don't have, like, Jesse Ventura, I don't know if you heard his comment last week, it's like a third world country. We have people running around with masks and long guns in the city streets, because that's what set America apart. We never had that. Now we do. And he refuses to call Trump anything other than a draft-dodging coward. Now, that's Jesse, not me. Now, but if you think that, oh, by the way, these people, all they're doing is sheltering illegal people that shouldn't be here, and your law and order on this is a thing that you ought to do, and the fact that the police and other people won't help you is a problem with them, and if somebody goes into a minor court of law with a traffic violation and you see the person isn't a citizen, if you don't immediately call ICE and the local people, somehow you're part of the problem. And all of a sudden the ICE gets some pushback, which they are getting. Well, now all of a sudden they can't do that. We need more people to protect the ICE. And if that doesn't work, we need more people to do even that. It rolls down that road just like water down a hill, doesn't it?
That's a plan.
Yeah. Well, you think it is? I think it might be.
Yeah, and, you know, just if you send in 3,000 people, that's vastly more federal agents. That's vastly more than the police departments of Minneapolis and St. Paul combined. And if they're using these roughhouse tactics, then ultimately there's going to be some pushback. And then you declare, it's an insurrection. And what Jesse Ventura, I saw the long version of the interview, and he didn't look for to weigh in. Actually, he was going to his high school reunion, and he came out of the building, and there were a bunch of reporters there, partly because there was the nearby ICE raids. And he got rolling, and his comment about draft dodging coward was kind of in the middle of things. In fact, he said something like, all right, I'm here to celebrate with my football buddies what we did when we went to school. But if you want a quote, and then he did the quote. But there's a lot of people who fear that this was a plan to basically federalize and militarize law enforcement locally and pick a spot, create a crisis, and then activate the Insurrection Act in a kind of test case nationwide in advance of the elections, where you can just go into neighborhoods and say, okay, this is a dangerous area, we're in charge now federally. So that's the concern.
Why do people who are backers not at least sense some of this going on? Or do they ignore it?
We talked about it at the beginning. People want to think things are normal and that their votes were justified both in 2016 and last year. And I'd like to just clarify, because I was a little vague before when you were talking about congressional testimony. I think it's helpful to be more specific than I was about the dangers. So in the case of Comey, what the administration really wants to put him in prison for is that he received complaints or evidence when he was FBI director in 2016, that there might be Russian interference in the 2016 election. So they began a preliminary investigation to see if there's evidence. So that's really why the Trump administration and the president want to put him in prison. But the statute of limitations of 2016 has expired. And so he was brought in September 2020 before a Senate committee, and he was asked, did you leak information to, did you authorize people to leak information about this 2016 investigation. And he said no. And so he's now under indictment, kind of, for lying about that. And yet there's no evidence that he actually did authorize anyone, or there's scant evidence. And all of the career prosecutors said, we don't see the evidence that he actually lied. And so they either quit or were fired. So that's the specifics.
I asked the question, I've got another topic like I unfortunately do. So what exactly are they accusing Powell of lying about? The budget for the remodeling of the place or something?
Yeah, basically. And this came up on the tour there. Remember, they were all both in hard hats. And
yeah, it looked pretty ridiculous, but yeah.
And Powell's view is, oh, you got this old building. this went through normal processes. And in a sense, the allegation, I mean, he hasn't actually been indicted, but the kind of reporting on it is, well, maybe the overruns were not.
But supposedly he said something to Congress. That's the.
Yeah, yeah. And that gets very murky. And I think that what might be going on, I mean, he's definitely going to leave as chairman, I think. But I think he has the ability to stay on as a member of the board. Where and that might be a seat that the administration and wants him out completely, not just as a member.
Well, the chairman usually does resign.
They usually do, but the irony in this is these heavy-handed tactics. He may or may not decide. Well, look, I'm going to stick around.
For those that don't know what the hell we're talking about, the chairman of the Fed has to come from somebody who's on the board. So he was on the board for a term, and then the chairman term, which he served two terms, it does not necessarily correlate with your term on the board. So his term as chairman is up in May, and he's obviously not going to be reappointed. But his term on the board, I think, is another 2 years or 18 months. It's a while. And so if he were to say, I'm staying, now Trump has to pick the new chairman from somebody who's on the board. Now, plus they're going to get the Supreme Court decision on the other lady he tried to boot off next week. If they say that she can't be booted by him and Powell doesn't leave, he's going to have to pick probably the last guy he put on there is going to be the chairman, whoever that is. But he won't be able to put somebody from the outside on there because there's not a board seat available. Am I correct?
I think so. You're drilling down much farther than the usually short news articles that have the Sturm und Drang. But basically what's going on, I believe.
And who's the last guy he put on? That guy will end up being the chairman. Tells his name. He's the guy who voted for a 2% drop the last month.
There's someone who's also got a White House position concurrently with his Fed position.
That's the guy.
Which is unusual. And
I forget his name.
I think that's the one. The name escapes me now, but I think that's the one you're talking about.
Yeah, he'll end up having to be the chairman.
Well, and he's proven his loyalty by doing the unprecedented... which is take the Fed position for the last 6 months while also working in the White House.
Allegedly, he's only getting paid for one, though.
Well, the stakes are in all of these jobs are way beyond.
Powell only makes bringing up the dash here, but Powell, there's a lot of people at the Fed that make more than he does. He makes like $200,000. There's people at the Fed, economists and stuff that I knew a few of them. They made way more than that. And so, you know, the idea that he has to go hire a law firm for like $100,000, you could beat up the guy pretty good with that. Now,
that's just for starters.
Yeah.
I mean, the starter is maybe $20,000 for initial consultation, but This can be hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Well, and Janet Yellen, as you guys probably figured out, I'm just as accusatorial toward the Democrats. She was a chairman of the Fed, went off, and I have a list here in my stuff of all the places she went. She made $7 million on speaking engagements from all the people she allegedly was supposed to be regulating when she was a Fed chairman. And then she was brought back by Biden as being... Now, if you go ahead and you do that, all right, I guess it's okay. I don't know if I really like it all that much, but I guess it's okay. But then after you've got all this money from these people, we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars, like Citadel and places like that. Now they bring her back in a regulatory position. How the hell do you go regulate people who just gave you $7 million?
Well, it's difficult, and that's what I was referencing. Once people have these positions and they do things that keep the big boys happy, there's a lifetime of board memberships and speaking gigs like that.
Like Wayne has. Can you imagine Wayne being on like 10 different boards?
Yeah, I just like to go to the money, be invited to the money room at the Federal Reserve on the second floor and see if they give out some free samples.
Well, you know, we had a guy, last crazy comment, we had a guy that was put on as one of the outside people of the CBOE board, right? And most of the people on the board, they were really pretty nice and pretty bright. And so this guy comes on, he was like a professional board sitter, this older dude, and he goes, you know, just so everybody knows, because there was always like a lunch served at these things, he wants his tuna sandwich with provolone on rye every one of the times. Okay, and I'm sitting there going, there's always good food at this thing. Well, he reserved the right that if the food was good enough to just kind of leave his tuna fish sandwich. But if it was something he didn't like, then he had his tuna fish sandwich. And I'm sitting there going, you know, somehow or another, I don't think this guy would be a beer drinking buddy of mine. Just saying. You know, you look at this stuff and you go, how could somebody possibly say something like that when all they do is serve great chow? And by the way, if you don't like it, you can not have something for a lunch. You'll survive.
Well, it's good to know the world is in good hands like that.
Sure. Guys, thank you very much. Let's hope we're not declaring martial law up there. One of the guys I was with last night, he's an old carpenter, an old kind of hippie kind of guy. He was a vet. He goes, he's going to go out and demonstrate again on the, for whatever, the No Kings thing. Because, but it's a problem. He's 78 years old. He goes, you know, you got to go to the bathroom, and none of these places, if you're demonstrating, will let you in to use the bathroom. and when you're in your late 70s, you got to go to the bathroom once in a while because it's hard to be a demonstrator as if you're older.
You may need to use a Trump option in that case.
Anyway, thanks, guys, and have a nice week. SP Futures up 34, NASDAQ Futures up 282. Talk to you guys next week. Good job, Jimmy. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.